Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee.
Excuse me, Tiffany, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Could we stop the jingle bells, please?
Okay, go ahead.
For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Well, all right, I made you a deal last week. I said that if I got enough emails during the week, that I would let you enjoy your Christmas, and then the Sunday immediately after Christmas, I would teach on the traditions of Christmas. And I guess I spurred some sort of curiosity out there because I got plenty of emails. So apparently lots of people would like to know why it is that we do the things we do every year around December 25th. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning. We're going to take a little break from our verse-by-verse exposition of Luke, and we're going to talk about Christmas this morning. So now that you've had your Christmas celebration, and you've gotten all your gifts, and you've done all your stuff, and you've eaten lots of turkey, now we can talk about the traditions without offending anybody, because you have a whole year to basically get over it. Okay? Okay, good. I saw perhaps the most bizarre Christmas thing. I was talking to Brent on the phone up in Chicago, and I have satellite TV, so I hit the little guide to see what's on, and I saw that VH1 was just playing Christmas music. So I said, okay, let's see what that is. So I flip over to Christmas music. Now I've got the volume down, and all I see is this white-robed choir standing among red poinsettias with the green ivy leaves, which I will show you in a few minutes, all come straight from Babylon. And standing in the middle of them singing a song is Neil Diamond, who himself is Jewish, which seemed odd to me and struck my curiosity. I wondered, gee, what sort of Christmas song could Neil Diamond be singing? So I turn up the volume and he's singing, "Morning has broken like the first morning," which is not a Christmas song. It is, in fact, a song written by Cat Stevens, who earlier this year was not allowed back into the United States because he is a radical Muslim. Let's put the pieces together for a moment. VH1 was playing a choir standing in a Babylonian setting with a Jewish guy singing a song written by a radical Muslim for Christmas. And everybody was fine with this. No one cared because we just love our traditions. You're not supposed to ask questions where these sort of traditions are concerned. I personally don't like the hypocrisy that I see in the church world where at the end of every October, they go absolutely ballistic about Halloween, because Halloween is obvious. They say, oh, Halloween, bad, pumpkins, devils, trick-or-treat, dressing up, All Saints' Eve, Halloween, bad. And 2 months later, we'll utterly and completely embrace the Christ Mass, which has every bit, if not more, connection to ancient Babylon than Halloween ever did, but they will embrace it. Pardon me?
From Rome,
the Christ Mass was being shown on TV. Absolutely. And that's precisely what it is. When you say the word Christmas, it is a conjunction of two Latin words, the Christ Mass. Christe Masse is actually it. Now, you need to know that the word Mass comes from the word Massa, which are round barley cakes baked to the Queen of Heaven, mentioned in the Old Testament as a don't do. Don't participate in cooking cakes to the Queen of Heaven. The sign of the Queen of Heaven in much of ancient Babylonish culture is this sign right here. It looks like a cross. It's actually a T standing for Tammuz, and it has the sun behind it. And so you were once Catholic, yes? Those of you who grew up Catholic probably remember that at the Mass, what do? They hand you a little round wafer with that symbol on it, coming straight from Babylon, handed down straight from the Catholic Church directly to you. And you're not supposed to question that. You're supposed to just do it. Well, I'm the sort of guy who goes around and questions those sort of things, wants to know why we do these sort of things. And I think that if the church is going to rise up against Halloween because of its pagan influence and roots, we ought to equally rise up against Christmas and say, well, it is also equally pagan, and recognize it for what it is. It's easy for most of us to figure out that Jesus could not have been born on December 25th. Just the basic details tell you that. It says that in the field there were shepherds watching their flocks by night. Go to Israel in December, there are no shepherds watching flocks by night. It's too cold. It was cold then, it's cold now. You can look on our website and read in the Christmas Q&A, where I take the time to lay out how you can figure out the birth of Christ, given the chronology in the book of Luke. He was probably born in late September, probably right around Feast of Trumpets, which would explain why there was no room at the inn. So what I'm going to do this morning, what the plan is this morning, it would be easy for me to stand up here and just say, this, and this, but you could say, well, a lot of that is Jim's opinion. And I know that normally I just kind of speak extemporaneously, and you guys go, well, I assume Jim knows what he's talking about. We'll take him at his word. This morning I have a gang of notes. I'll try to get through them in an hour. I'm going to be doing a lot of reading, and I'm going to read other people, other authorities, everything from encyclopedias to books that have been around for hundreds of years. And nothing, I'm here to tell you, nothing I say to you this morning cannot be corroborated by you just taking the time to go and research the exact same stuff I did. It's very available. It's all over the internet. Do a Google search on History of Christmas, and you will find everything I'm going to tell you this morning. The problem is people don't want to hear the stuff I'm going to tell you this morning because it does pull the rug out from under our comfortable traditions. And you know that I am, when it comes to Christianity, I am an anti-traditionalist. I am very much a fool for sound doctrine. And I will say at the end, I'm going to say it now, and I'll say it again at the end, I'm not the great Scrooge, I'm not the great cosmic killjoy. Yesterday I got together with my brother and sister-in-law and my nieces and my mom, and we ate turkey and chocolate goodies, and we exchanged gifts, and we had a very nice time. But I've never taught my children Santa Claus. I've never taught them anything about St. Nicholas, who we will talk about this morning, give you some of the history of, because I never wanted them to be able to question whether or not Dad told them the truth. And when they come to me and say, Dad, is there a God? And I look them in the eye and say, yes. And they say, did Jesus live and did he die on a tree? And I say, yes. I don't ever want that to be confounded by, is there a fat man who comes down the chimney and leaves me gifts every year? And I say, yes. If I equally say yes to that, and I say, yes, there's a Jesus, and yes, there's a God, when I take away Santa Claus, the next thing they're going to ask is, well, then what about God? Because, you know, as a kid, when my mom, who's sitting in the back of the room this morning, when my mom told me there is no Santa Claus, right, I asked you, is there a God? Because from my perspective, Santa Claus had proof. He brought me stuff. Right? What did God ever do for me? Santa brought me stuff. We would leave cookies and milk out, and he would eat the cookies and milk. He liked the cookies and milk. We did things for him. He did things for us. This was a fair exchange. But God, that was too wide a concept for me to grasp. So I decided, because of my own difficulties as a child dealing with the God Santa Claus question, that I wouldn't teach that to my children. And then as I've become an adult and have done the research into the customs and why we talk about Santa Claus, I no longer in good conscience can bring the concept of Santa Claus into my house. Okay, so that's the stuff we're going to talk about this morning. But like always, you know, churches just love their traditions. Church is built by and large on tradition. And it's very hard to get them to let go of their tradition. It's very hard to get America to let go of its tradition, because I just read a report on the internet. Most retailers this year, Walmart, Sears, the big retailers, do a third of their total sales volume between Halloween and Christmas. What does that mean? That means that the American economy is absolutely dependent at this point on Christmas. So you're not going to get them to give it up. Nor do I think I'm going to be able to change the world by standing up here and telling them the truth. But I think it's worthwhile that we know the truth. And then I will leave it up to you and your individual conscience to raise your family the way you see fit. Okay? I won't be coming over to your house and tearing down your manger scenes. Okay? Except the one in my neighborhood where they have a manger scene with the shepherds over the Christ child in an open manger. You know that he wasn't in an open manger, right? He was in a grotto. A manger in those days was a cave underneath a dwelling where animals could be put at night to be warm, but they could also cover the front of it to keep the animals in there. How do you keep animals in an open manger like the type you see in the front of most people's yards? It doesn't even make sense. But anyways, they had the shepherds in there. They had the wise men in there. Wise men were never at the manger. Get that in your head. They were never at the manger. I don't care how many Christmas plays you go to, there were no wise men at the manger. Didn't happen. If we have time this morning, we'll look at that out of the Bible. And then they had Santa Claus in the manger in my neighborhood right now. You can go drive over there, and you've got your shepherds, you've got your wise men, you've got Santa Claus, all together in the manger, worshiping the Christ child. This is a beautiful thing. So, the early church, let's start there. One prolific writer in the early church was a fellow named Irenaeus, who was the bishop over all the churches of Asia Minor, and he was the bishop following John the Apostle and Polycarp, and then comes this Irenaeus. He was bishop of Asia from 170 to 180 AD. He took the time to write about all the church observances over the course of a year. Nowhere is Christmas mentioned or the observance of a day for the supposed birth of Jesus. You can check out Irenaeus' writing in English at the Wheaton University website. You can go check it out for yourself. I did. He does not mention Christmas anywhere. Now, you're talking about 170 to 180 AD. This is the first 200 years of the church's existence. There is no mention of Christmas. There is no mention of the birth of Christ or observing it in the early church. It simply didn't happen. This is a later creation. Also, Tertullian, you've heard me speak of him before. Born somewhere around 150, 160 AD. Died somewhere between 220 and 240. No one's really sure. He also created a list of church observances, never mentioned Christmas. So now we're well into the early 200s, still no mention of Christmas or an observance of the birth of Jesus. But he openly condemned the practices of sun god worship that were beginning to be a part of the church. And what I'm going to show you this morning is that Christmas is a continuation of the same type of sun god worship that has overtaken Easter, the Ishtar feast. For heaven's sake, we even call it Ishtar. When everybody runs out at sunrise to watch the rising of the sun, do I have to spell that one out for you? Christmas is equally a pagan sun god time of worship. Augustine, you've heard the name Augustine. I talk a lot about Augustine here, Augustine of Hippo, North Africa. 354 to 430 AD, we're now working our way into the 400s AD, bitterly denounced the identification of Jesus with the sun god. It was Pope Leo I, often called Pope Leo the Great, because, you know, popes are humble. He openly denounced solar festivals when Christians would gather on the very steps of the Apostles' Basilica and they would turn to adore the rising sun. So in the 300s and 400s, you see the early inculcation of sun worship working its way into Christianity, but you have popes and you've got Augustine decrying these facts and trying to hold it back from working its way into Christianity. Now, the Catholic Encyclopedia states that shortly after the Council of Nicaea, this is 325 AD, a pope who was probably Pope Julius I in 349 AD, for the first time assigned December 25th as the day for observing the birth of Jesus. Then in the 5th century AD, another pope made it a church law that all Christians would observe December 25th as Christmas forever. Now, why December 25th? Why is it that December 25th of all days was chosen as the day that we would observe the birth of Christ? The date of December 25th was chosen over 300 years after the death of Jesus. Now, that's a very important thing to remember, that after Jesus died, for the first 300 years of Christendom on planet Earth, no one ever stopped on December 25th to think about the birth of Jesus. It didn't exist. The World Book Encyclopedia, again, these are things you can look up yourself, easy sources, admits the World Book Encyclopedia, quote, "The exact date of Christ's birth is not known. The early Christians did not celebrate his birth because they considered the celebration of anyone's birth to be a pagan custom. The first mention of the observance of Christ's birthday appears in AD 200. For many years, several dates were used. December 25th was first mentioned in perhaps 336. That's the World Book Encyclopedia under the article Christmas. These things are not hard to find out. When the Catholic Mass was first said at midnight on December 24th, around the year 394 AD, it was for the first time called the Mass of Christ or the Christ Mass. The apostate religious machine of the day changed it from Baal's birthday to the birthday of Jesus. The pagans loved it. It became the biggest day of the year for the Roman Catholic institution. In fact, Cardinal Newman, this is recent, who lived from 1801 to 1890, often called the father of the Second Vatican Council, wrote in his book, The Development of Christian Doctrine, quote, "We are told by Eusebius that Constantine, in order to recommend the new religion of Christianity to the heathen, transferred into it the outward ornaments to which they had been accustomed on their own. The use of temples, and these dedicated to particular saints, and ornamented on occasions with branches of trees, incense, lamps and candles, votive offerings on recovery from illness, holy water, asylums, holy days and seasons, use of calendars, processions, blessings on the field, sacerdotal vestments, the tonsure or the shaving of your head, the ring in marriage, turning to the east, images at a later date, perhaps the ecclesiastical chant, all of these are of pagan origin, and they were sanctified by their adoption into the church." Now, what Cardinal Newman is claiming is that, yes, all these things are absolutely pagan, but that because the church eventually adopted them, the Roman Catholic Church adopted them, that they were sanctified by the use of the church. He's wrong. They are still pagan in their origin, and they are still worshiping pagan gods. The fact that the Catholic Church adopted them means nothing. Now, he's right. Constantine, in the early 300s, was a Roman emperor who had a problem on his hands, which is that for the first 300 years of Christianity, there had been a great deal of persecution against the Christian populace. He also had a large Jewish populace to deal with, and then he had this large pagan culture that was celebrating all these mystery religions handed down to them from Babylon. So he had a conflict in publicly allowing each of these different groups to celebrate their particular holidays and holy days and to worship. Oftentimes they wanted to use the same places to worship, the same temples, the same meeting places. Well, Constantine claimed to have seen the cross of Christ during a battle, and he was told that as long as he saw, or as long as he fought under the image of the cross, that he would prevail. However, in Constantine's life, he continued to build temples to foreign gods as well as to Christ. So he never really fully embraced Christianity. Nevertheless, he Christianized Rome and made it the official state religion of Rome. The problem was he had all these pagans who really liked their traditions, and he imposed Christianity on them. So what do? Well, you let them continue doing everything they're already doing. You just call them Christians. You just let them go ahead and celebrate all their pagan feasts. You just make them Christian feasts. All these different pagan feasts were brought into the Christian church and stamped onto Christianity. Every year at the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, they would celebrate the rebirth of the sun god, Tammuz. The shortest day on that night, they would throw a log called the Yule log. Yule means sun. They would throw a Yule log onto the fire. And their belief was from the ashes of the Yule log, the next day, a fir tree would spring to life. And that fir tree was a symbol of Tammuz, the rebirth of the sun god. This goes way, way historically before Christianity. The idea of throwing a Yule log on the fire, and the next morning there's a fir tree decked out in gold and silver with gifts under it, all predates Christianity by a long shot. This is all straight from Babylon. And so what does Constantine do? He says, well, this is all Christian now. Instead of celebrating the birth of the sun, S-U-N, we'll just make it the birth of the sun, S-O-N. And there you go, you've got your Christ Mass. And that's what we still celebrate every December 25th. And the Christian church has embraced it. E.G. White writes in his book, The Great Controversy, "The pagan god Tammuz was born on December 25th. Quote, born on December 25th, he represented the rebirth of the sun. As the pagan god child, he was called Baal Berith, who was the lord of the fir tree." You see now why I have trouble bringing a Christmas tree into my house? He was called the Lord of the Fir Tree. The word Yule is a Babylonian word for infant, and December 25th was called by the pagan Anglo-Saxons Yule Day. which is why you can still get cards that, you know, say to have a blessed Yuletide. Celebrate Baal. I think I told you that I went in Target recently, and they had big banners because they don't want to say Merry Christmas because they don't want to offend anybody, and they've already chased away the Salvation Army Santas from all of their stores. So they have big banners up now that say Happy Winter Solstice. And I thought, well, great, we've come full circle. At least they are admitting what it really is. White also writes that other false gods were born on December 25th. Included in this was Mithra. Now, you need to get to know this name, Mithra. Mithraism. Significantly, Mithra is the Roman sun god. The false worship of Mithra migrated to Rome from Pergamos. You may be familiar with Pergamos, Revelation 2, 12 to 13. Remember the Revelation studies? You read about Pergamos. What did I tell you Pergami stands for? Anybody remember?
Purgatory sound.
It does. Well, and very similar root. What is monogamy?
Being exclusive.
Married to one person. Yeah. What is polygamy?
Yeah.
Polygamy. Many, many people you've married. Yeah. What is pergamy? Bad marriage. Pergamy, its name, Pergamos, has to do with the bad marriage of the Christian church with Roman paganism. That's the place where it got its greatest foothold and is known by the infamous name of Pergamy to this day. Christmas was not made official dogma of the Holy Roman Empire until 534 AD. Now think about that for a moment. We as a nation are what, 200 years old? And how many changes have we gone through in 200 years? 500 years from the death and birth of Christ to the time that Christmas was first officially observed by the Roman Catholic Church. That's a long time. Jesus has been gone for 2,000 years. For the first quarter of that, Christmas was not considered an official observance of the birth of Christ. This is significant. There is nothing Christian about Christmas. Christmas was not celebrated by the early American Puritans, as I'll talk about in a moment, and was across the board denounced by American Calvinists who landed on the shores of the United States. Calvinism never embraced Christmas, but you can go to most Reformed Calvinistic churches today, and they'll have trees in their sanctuaries. A broad element of English Christianity still considers Christmas celebration to be a pagan blasphemy. The Puritans, the Baptists, the Quakers, the Presbyterians, the Calvinists, and other denominations brought this opposition to early New England, and strong opposition to the holiday lasted in America until the middle of the 18th century. Rick Meisel wrote that in his book, The Origins of Christmas, which came out in 1993. He recognizes that in early America, the Puritans, the Pilgrims, the Calvinists who landed here would not celebrate Christmas because they understood that it was pagan and they wouldn't have it. In fact, Christmas was generally outlawed in America until the end of the last century. Up until 1870, the city of Boston proclaimed that anyone who missed work on Christmas Day would automatically be fired because they did not want you to observe that day. Now, no one works on Christmas. 1870, that's only, what, 130, 140 years ago that it was outlawed in America. Factory owners required employees to come to work at 5 a.m. on Christmas Day in order to ensure that they would not go to church that day. It's true. And any student who failed to go to school on December 25th was summarily expelled because they were trying very hard to keep Christmas from spreading. Alabama was the first state in the Union to recognize Christmas as a legal holiday, but that was late in the 19th century. So, roll tide. So. The Babylonian connection. Let's talk about that. The winter solstice was also celebrated by the followers of Mithra as the nativity or the birth of the sun, S-U-N. Mithra was the Persian sun god, and his worship was widespread throughout the Roman Empire in the days of the early believers. When the feast was celebrated in Rome, it was called the Festival of Saturn or the Saturnalia, and it lasted for 5 days. and it was celebrated during the shortest days, during the winter solstice, the shortest days of the year. In both ancient Rome and more ancient Babylon, this festival was characterized by bouts of drunkenness, wild merrymaking, and lascivious orgies, which would begin with an innocent kiss underneath mistletoe. Absolutely. And then would lead to the justification of all sorts of sexual excesses, perversions, and abominations. Alexander Hislop writes in his book, The Two Babylons, he writes, quote, "Indeed, it is admitted by the most learned and candid writers of all parties that the day of our Lord's birth cannot be determined exactly, and that within the Christian church, no such festival as Christmas was ever heard of until the 3rd century, and that not till the 4th century was far advanced did it gain much observance at all. Long before the 4th century and long before the Christian era itself, a festival was celebrated among the heathen at that precise time of year in honor of the birth of the son of the Babylonian Queen of Heaven. And it may fairly be presumed that, in order to conciliate the heathen and to swell the number of nominal adherents to Christianity, that the same festival was adopted by the Roman Church, giving it only the name of Christ, the Christ Mass. This tendency on the part of Christians to meet paganism halfway was very early developed, and we find Tertullian, even in his day, about the year 230, bitterly lamenting the inconsistency of the disciples of Christ in this respect and contrasting it with the strict fidelity of the pagans to their own superstition. Do you understand the brilliance of what Hislop said there? He said the church, unfortunately, has a long history of being willing to meet pagans halfway in order to bring nominal adherents into the church. Not people who really genuinely believe or understand, but let's just get more bodies into the church by allowing them to keep whatever heathen customs they want to keep, but bring them in. Meanwhile, the heathens were much more likely to hold on to fastidiously every one of their beliefs and every one of their traditions. It was never the heathens who had to change to be part of the church. It was always the church that changed in order to accommodate the heathens.
Still like that.
Yeah, exactly right. James George Frazer wrote in his book, The Golden Bough, A Study in Magic and Religion, 1922, he wrote, "The largest pagan religious cult, which fostered the celebration of December 25th as a holiday throughout the Roman and Greek worlds, was the pagan sun worship, Mithraism." He adds, "This winter festival was called the Nativity of the Sun, the S-U-N. Mithra was not the only pagan deity that was said to be born at this time of year. Osiris, Horus, Hercules, Bacchus, Adonis, Jupiter, Tammuz, and all the other sun gods were supposedly born at the time of the winter solstice." Alexander Hislop, I'm going to quote again, says, "That Christmas was originally a pagan festival is beyond all doubt. The time of the year and the ceremonies with which it is still celebrated prove its origin. In Egypt, the son of Isis, the Egyptian title for the Queen of Heaven, was born at this very time. The ancient books read about the time of the winter solstice for his birthday. The very name by which Christmas is popularly known among ourselves, the Yule Day, proves at once its pagan and Babylonish origin. Yule is the Chaldee name for an infant or a little child, and as the 25th of December was called by our pagan Anglo-Saxon ancestors the Yule Day or the Child's Day, and the night that preceded was called Mother's Night, all these things occurred long before they came in contact with Christianity, and that sufficiently proves its real character. Far and wide, in the realms of paganism, it was the birthday that was observed for the sun god." So what do we all do? Keep that name Christ Mass, and then observe all the same old pagan stuff, and just say, but it's really Christian. It frustrates me when I hear, and I know this will be controversial, but ooh, I've always shied away from controversy. It really bothers me to hear Christian people say, let's put Christ back into Christmas. I understand what they're saying. they're complaining that the commercialism of Christmas has taken away the religious element of Christmas. And I understand what they're saying. Let's refocus back on the importance of Christmas as Christ. But Christ was never in the Christ Mass. It was a pagan holiday. Rather than the church rallying around, let's put Christ back into Christmas, the church really ought to rally around, let's put Christianity back in our calendar. And let's take this Christ Mass paganism and set it aside, which, again, won't happen because the American culture and economy won't ever allow it. Ralph Woodrow, in his book Babylon Mystery Religion, writes, "The feast of Christmas was the most vile, immoral feast that ever disgraced pagan Rome. It was a season of license, drunkenness, and debauchery when all restraints of law were laid aside." Hyslop goes on to write, "The feast of Saturn lasted 5 days. Loose reins were given to drunkenness and revelry. Slaves had a temporary emancipation, and they used all manner of freedoms with their masters. This was precisely the way in which, according to Berosus, that the drunken festival in the month of Thebeth, T-H-E-B-E-T-H, would you pronounce that? Thebeth, Thebeth, any idea? Answering to our December, in other words, the festival of Bacchus, from which we get the word Bacchanalia, which means drunken festival orgy, happened on December 25th each year, and that again are the roots of Christmas." T.G. Crippen wrote a book in 1923 called Christmas and Christmas Lore. Look it up. He writes, "Now in December and the beginning of January, there were several festivals which were intimately associated with the daily life of the Roman people. First, from the 17th to the 21st of December was the Saturnalia, the great Roman holiday. One might call it the Feast of Topsy-Turvydom, when slaves were allowed a few days to enjoy the semblance of freedom, and they were waited upon by their masters, and they chose from among themselves a mock king to preside over their revelry. Next, on the 22nd of December, came Sigillaria, which was the Feast of Dolls, when a fair was held, and dolls and other toys, mostly earthenware, were given to children. Then on the 25th came Brumalia, otherwise it was called Dies Natalis Invicti Solis, the birthday of the unconquered sun, S-U-N. When the days began to lengthen right after the winter solstice, it is believed to have been instituted by the Emperor Aurelian in honor of Mithra, the Persian sun god." This is our history. Okay, want to talk about the Christmas tree?
Sure.
This will make you not want a tree anymore. Are you okay with that? Okay. I'm just going to keep pulling rugs out from under your traditions.
You're only mistletoe. That's, you know, that's
all. Oh, I haven't gotten to mistletoe yet.
But that seems to get the whole party started. I just don't know.
Hyslop writes, "The Christmas tree, now so common among us, was equally common in pagan Rome and in pagan Egypt. In Egypt, that tree was usually a palm tree. In Rome, it was a fir tree, as we use today. The palm tree denoted the pagan messiah, Baal Tamar. The fir tree referred to him as Baal Berith. The mother of Adonis, the sun god, and the great mediatorial divinity, was mystically said to have changed into a tree, and when in that state, to have brought forth her divine son. If the mother was a tree, then the son must have been recognized as man the branch. And this entirely accounts for the putting of a Yule log into the fire on Christmas Eve and the appearance of the Christmas tree the next morning." He goes on to write on page 98 of his book, "Therefore, the 25th of December, the day that was observed at Rome as the day of the victorious God reappearing on earth, was held as the Natalis Invicti Solis, the birthday of the unconquered sun. Now the Yule log is the dead stock of Nimrod, deified as the sun god, but cut down by his enemies, and the Christmas tree is Nimrod Redivivus, the slain god, come to life again." That's what the Christmas tree always represented. It's just that we Christianized it in some peculiar way and said it is a sign of everlasting life. But the ancient carvings of Nimrod, ancient wood carvings of Nimrod, usually have him holding a fir tree, a sign of everlasting life. And those images of Nimrod are usually of a man with a long white beard. We'll get to him. Yes, son?
Okay,
Okay, so we know the mistake we made about the tree. Is God mad, or does he understand that this was all just a big misunderstanding?
Let me do all this and then answer that question to wrap up, okay?
Okay.
Okay. So the Yule log represented a piece of Nimrod who had been cut into many pieces by his enemies. Then he was deified as the sun god by those who loved him. The Yule log as Nimrod was put into the fire on Christmas Eve, and with a miraculous birth, the Christmas tree appears the next day. The tree represents Tammuz. It was claimed that this child was the rebirth of his father Nimrod, who was now a god. Similarly, the mistletoe is called the man of the branch, and the wreath is known as a sun wheel. Why do you think wreaths of mistletoe were always round? They're in the shape of the sun. They're called sun wheels in ancient Babylon. Nimrod is also mentioned in the Bible. He established the first great city of Babel, which is the foundation of Babylon. And then he established other cities, including the Assyrian cities. Genesis 10, 8 to 11 gives the account of all that. And it was his leadership that resulted, by the way, in God confusing all the languages of the world because he himself wanted to become deified. And so what have humans done? Deified him. The word Yule means infant in the languages of the Chaldeans who lived in the Middle East. The Germanic tribes of Northern Europe, including the Anglo-Saxons, celebrated the Yule Day or the Child's Day. Ralph Woodrow writes in his book, Babylon Mystery Religion, an old Babylonian fable went like this. Semiramis, the mother of Tammuz, claimed that overnight an evergreen tree sprang up from a dead tree stump. The dead stump supposedly symbolized her dead husband Nimrod. The new evergreen tree was a symbol that Nimrod had come to life again in the person of Tammuz. This idea spread and developed so that the various nations all have had their legends about sacred trees. Among the Druids, the oak was sacred. Among the Egyptians, it was the palm tree. And in Rome, it was the fir tree, which was decorated with red berries during the Saturnalia. According to the Scandinavians, the fir tree is the sacred emblem of their god Odin, sometimes called Woden, after whom we have a day in the middle of the week, Woden's Day, which is why Wednesday is spelled so weirdly as it made its way down to us. In Europe, the Saxons used to offer a boar in sacrifice to the sun to propitiate the Queen of Heaven on Christmas Day. The boar in pagan mythology was supposed to have slain the false pagan Messiah. The boar was also a major article in the Feast of Saturn at Rome, and the boar's head is still a standing dish in England as a Christmas dinner. Yes, ma'am?
You just put two things together that I've never heard put together before.
Okay.
Pagan Messiah.
Tammuz is considered the pagan Messiah by the fact that he is a child of the sun. He is God incarnate walking on planet Earth. But whenever you say the word, since you've brought that up, what does the word anti mean? Do you know?
Against.
Huh?
Against.
Against or substitute. Right. And so when we talk in the Bible about anti-Christ, what does the word Christ mean? Messiah. Right. Substitute Messiah, anti-Messiah. Even the Bible talks about pagan messiahs or pagan Christ, anti-Christ. So it's not a completely foreign concept, which is why Woodrow would use that kind of language.
So. And pagans aren't the same as atheists, like they still believe, right?
Oh, they believe. They just believe wrong things.
Right.
Yeah, sure. Everybody believes something. Everybody believes something. The worst atheist on the planet has a very firm set of beliefs that he is very convinced of, and he believes those things. His set of beliefs just doesn't include the idea of a Christian God. But he does believe in something bigger than himself because he knows he's alive and the universe exists. So, but you know that my concept is that true atheism doesn't exist anyway. There can be Gnosticism, but true atheism, you'd have to be born, grow, and never have the concept of God ever introduced to you. And you can't live in any society in the world today and not have a God concept to be truly atheistic. But in any case. All right, I'm back to Alexander Hislop. There can be no doubt, then, that the pagan festival of the winter solstice, in other words, Christmas, was held in honor of the birth of the Babylonian Messiah. There, he used the same word, too. That's interesting that you pointed that out. The Northern Europeans worshipped the same gods as the ancient Babylonians, but under the name of Odin, who was the equivalent of Sol or Baal. He was the sun god. The evergreen fir tree is sacred to Odin, and people decorated it during the festival of Saturnalia. Legend has it that Odin would bestow Yuletide gifts to those who approached the sacred fir tree on the Brumalia. So we have trees with gifts under them, which Odin used to bring. The giving of presents on December 25th happened long before Rome arbitrarily chose December 25th as the supposed birthday of Jesus. The stories about St. Nicholas being the origination of giving presents is merely a church spin to try to put a Christian face on what was a pagan custom done hundreds of years before Christ. We'll talk about St. Nicholas in a minute, too. The tree even dates back to Baal worship in the Old Testament. Listen carefully to this. This is Jeremiah 10, 1 through 6. See if any of it strikes home now that you know that during Jeremiah's time there was a lot of tree worship going on. Jeremiah 10, 1 through 6. Hear ye the word of the Lord as he speaks unto you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them, for the customs of the people are vain. For one cuts down a tree in the forest, the work of the hands of a workman with an axe, and they deck it with silver and gold, and they fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it does not move. They are upright as a palm tree, but they can't speak, and they must needs be carried around, because they cannot go. Be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither also is it in them to do good. For as much as there is none like unto thee, O Lord, thou art great, and thy name is great in might. So even in Jeremiah, the people were warned, don't drag trees in from the forest into your house and decorate it with gold and silver. Because it was already happening back in Jeremiah's time, is the point. In the Old Testament, we learn that the worshipers of Baal set up what were called groves. When we find the word in its singular form, grove, it most often is a translation of the word Asherah, which in the Hebrew is a decorated tree, which was considered an image to Ashtar or Ashtoreth, also called Ishtar. 2 Kings chapter 23 is a perfect example of God's hatred for the customs of the heathen. So what does the church do? Inculcate them. Sure, we'll just Christianize them. It'll be fine. The modern Christmas tree was likely born in the 8th century when St. Boniface was converting the Germanic tribes. The tribes worshipped oak trees, and they would decorate them for the winter solstice. St. Boniface cut down an enormous oak tree that was central to the worship of a particular tribe, but a fir tree grew there in its place. And the evergreen was offered as a symbol of Christianity, which the newly converted Germans began decorating for Christmas. And Prince Albert, who was German, introduced the Christmas tree to England after his marriage to Queen Victoria in 1840. German immigrants to Pennsylvania brought the Christmas tree with them to America, and that's how we got it. A guy named Christram P. Coffin, in his book, The Book of Christmas Folklore, writes, most people have heard that the Christmas tree originates in the Tannenbaum and is some sort of vestige of Teutonic vegetation worship. However, the custom of using pine and other evergreen trees ceremonially was well established at the Roman Saturnalia and even earlier in Egypt. So the Christmas tree goes way back. It's not Christian. It's a sign of pagan worship to the sun god. Whether he's called Odin or whether he's called Tammuz, the Christmas tree is established as a form of worship for the sun god. Okay? Want to talk about Santa Claus?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Big, fat, jolly man who comes down your chimney and leaves you gifts, who has all these godlike qualities. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good, for goodness sake. Because Santa Claus is watching. He'll get you.
Be good because he'll bring you presents.
Be good because he'll bring you presents.
For goodness sake.
Absolutely. It's not for goodness sake. It's for stuff.
Yeah.
Often it is assumed that our notions of Santa Claus came down to us because of a kindly saint who gave gifts to children, but traditions of a god who gave gifts under an evergreen tree far predate Saint Nicholas, who was the saint of Asia Minor, and it predates him by thousands of years. Among the Scandinavians, it was the god Odin, or Woden, who left special gifts during the Yuletide season under an evergreen tree which was his sacred tree. So who is this Odin or Woden? He was the chief god of Norse mythology, and he was a fierce fighter who carried a spear as his special weapon, and he was renowned as a mighty hunter like Nimrod for his magical powers. Odin was another name for Nimrod, except that Odin could, catch this, fly. So he could bring gifts to all the children under his sacred fir tree. This is interesting. This next piece is written by a rabbi who was wise enough to look at the history and write about it. Rabbi, I hope I say this, Yeshaya Halkaiser. The rabbi writes, "Even Santa Claus, the most popular symbol of Christmas in the United States, has a pagan origin." Origin. Have I been saying it?
Yeah.
Okay. Has a pagan origin. Says the World Book Encyclopedia, this is still the rabbi I'm quoting, some of Santa Claus's characteristics date back many centuries. For example, the belief that Santa enters the house through a chimney developed from an old Nordic legend. The Norse believed that the goddess Hertha appeared in the fireplace and brought good luck to the home. But the most significant symbolism in this myth is that children are taught through it that he has many characteristics that only God actually has, like omniscience, knowing all. He knows when you've been bad or good. Omnipresence, being able to cover the whole world with gift-giving in one night, etc. Satan also wanted to take God's place and to be like God. Santa Claus, as I call this myth, is a substitute for God and for the supposed, quote, reason for the season. Santa Claus stands identified as none other than the original arch-apostate Nimrod. His attributes hark back to ancient pagan worship. When children are asked, "What did Santa Claus bring you this year?" it is merely a modern twist of an old satanic counterfeit pagan religion. The winter solstice occurs on December 25th, and Saturnalia was kept from December 17th to the 24th, and on December 25th, Brumalia was the celebration of the rebirth of the sun god. This is called Mithraism. It was a continuation of the Baal worship of ancient days. It was present in Egypt and back in ancient Babylon. December 25th is the birthday of Tammuz, the son of Semiramis, and the rebirth of Nimrod. The ancient legend is that a green tree sprang up on Brumalia, with the stump symbolizing Nimrod or Baal, and the green tree is Tammuz. This festival is nothing more than witchcraft institutionalized in the church today as Christmas, and it is Baal worship. All of that written by a rabbi observing Christians keeping Christmas. Who just bothered to go back and do the work? The Legend of St. Nicholas by Dr. Paul E. Heaton. He writes, "St. Nicholas, it is the Bishop Nicholas who is the patron saint of children. Patron means protector, defender, or father, or pater. Nicholas is from," now watch this, talking about St. Nicholas for a moment. By the way, what does the word saint mean?
Sanctified.
Exactly. In the Greek, it is hagios. It is the same Greek word that is translated holy. Saint, holy, set aside for God's own use. This saint was a 4th century bishop of Myra, who was supposedly a benevolent man who gave gifts to children, according to his legend. His birthday is December 6th, which is still celebrated as the Feast of Saint Nicholas. And it is said that the English of New York corrupted the Dutch celebration and made it part of their traditional Christmas. The word Christmas comes from the Christe Masse, which is the Christ Mass, also called the Feast of the Nativity. This all eventually led to the changing of the bishop's name to Santa Claus, because saint in Spanish or Latin languages is Santa. You know that, right? If you go out to Los Angeles, you can see Santa Monica, Santa Maria, Saint Mary, Santa Maria. Santa means saint. Santa means holy. As it worked its way through Nordic languages, Niklas was spelled like that, Santa Niklas. So Santa or Saint Niklas, over time, as it moved through the Nordic into the English languages, became Claus, Santa Claus. And you can see from there it's an easy jump to Santa Claus. It all refers back to Saint Nick. The real Saint Nicholas was Bishop of Asia Minor, the seaport city of Myra in the 4th century, and he attended the first great ecumenical council in Nicaea. He was the patron of sailors, of children, and of Russia, among others. Prior to being a bishop, this saint was, of course, a priest. He became a priest around the age of 19. Until about the 1800s, he, as Santa Claus, was portrayed as a tall, thin, stately man who wore bishop's robes and rode a white horse. Until 1809, when Washington Irving, 1783 to 1859, depicted him a bit differently in the book Knickerbocker's History of New York. In this poem, Irving represented him as a jolly man who wore a broadly brimmed hat and huge breeches and smoked a long pipe. He rode over the treetops in a wagon and filled children's stockings with presents. This portrayal of Santa Claus continued for more than 13 years, and then around 1822, a man named Clement Clark Moore, 1779 to 1863, an educator and an Episcopal clergyman, wrote the now famous poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." The original title of it was called A Visit from St. Nicholas. In this poem, he wrote about Santa Claus appearing as a stout, jolly man with twinkling eyes and a red nose and a red suit, trimmed with white fur, and he rides in a sleigh being pulled by reindeer. Professor John Lynch writes, "This cult, his cult and the representation in art achieved its greatest popularity in the Middle Ages, and in England alone, more than 400 churches are now named after Santa Claus, St. Nicholas." Here's a picture that I printed out that I'll leave up here. Y'all can come look at it if you want. This is an original rendering of what Santa Claus looked like before a night before Christmas, when suddenly he became a jolly fat man in a red suit. And a couple of the characteristics I want you to see immediately. This picture shows what Santa appeared like prior to the 1800s. Note that he's dressed in a red cape and that he appears to be a Catholic bishop, more than the jolly old elf that brings children presents. Notice all the missing white trim around the edge of his clothing and his hat, and also notice that he is wearing a gown underneath his robe. If compared to pictures of Nimrod in mythology, we find both have long beards and ornate dress. Nimrod either carries a tiny deer or has a spotted deerskin robe. In this picture, he has a small deer with him, the origin of the notion that he is pulled by reindeer when he comes to your house. He carries a tree branch in the other hand. Nimrod is also pictured often to have wings, giving him the power to fly through the air. And as you can see from this picture, circa 1800s, of Santa, of St. Nick, he's wearing Catholic robes as a cardinal in the church. That's who supposedly is coming into your house every week. And yet, it just astounds me that supposedly Protestant people, who would say, "We are Protestant, we're not Catholic," will take all of these things that the Catholic Church took from Babylonish mystery religion and imposed onto the birth of Christ, and the supposedly Protestant Church has embraced them all and said, "Oh, we're fine with that." And even call him Saint Nick. Does the Protestant Church saint people? No, of course not. Who does that? Well, the Catholic Church. But we're Protestant. Kris Kringle, another name for Santa Claus, developed in Germany around 1600. German Protestants recognized December 25th, the birth of the Christ child, called the Christkindl, as a time to give gifts. Christkindl evolved into the name Kris Kringle. And so that became another name for Santa Claus. They're all tied together. In the Netherlands and Germany, the Santa Claus figure often rode through the sky on a horse to deliver presents to children. He often wore a bishop's robes and was sometimes accompanied by Black Peter, an elf who would whip the naughty children.
I'll take cold.
You could, exactly. Completely politically incorrect by the time it got to America. We must rid ourselves of Black Peter, who whips children. Why do you think the common concept is that Santa leaves black coal? It's just we'll get rid of Black Peter and we'll leave black coal behind for bad kids.
Yeah, switches and ashes.
Switches and ashes, oh yeah. Some of Santa Claus' characteristics date back many centuries. For instance, the belief that Santa enters the house through the chimney developed from an old Norse legend. And the Norse believed that the goddess Hertha appeared in the fireplace and brought good luck to your home. So again, just take all the traditions, put them in a big pile, shake them all up, dump them out, however they come out. That's us, we believe it, let's go. But we're Christians, and Protestant Christians at that.
So is that James question?
Yeah, I've already talked about mistletoe, I'll skip it. I'll make these notes available to anybody who wants them. and you can study them for yourself. I have a thing in here on nativity scenes. You didn't see nativity scenes before 1223. St. Francis of Assisi was the first guy to decide he wanted a living nativity scene. You don't see that for the first 1200 years of the church. And let me wrap up by reading something that I found in Hinduism Today. Yes, that's right. Hinduism Today, December 24th, 2003. I've read a rabbi. I've read from an encyclopedia. I'm now going to read from the Hindus. My point is this. The rest of the world that is not Christian, whether it's because they're agnostic or whether it's because they believe something else, all understand that the Christian church has embraced a completely ancient pagan concept and that they have imposed it onto the birth of their Messiah. And they get that. And they see the foolishness of it. And when they want to write against Christianity, it's real easy for them to say, look at how foolish the Christians are. They don't even know their own history. They don't even know that they're worshiping an ancient sun god and claiming that it's the birth of their Jesus when there's no way that Jesus could have been born that day. The world is not stupid, and the anti-Christian world is not stupid, and they do get how stupid it is that Christianity has embraced the Christ Mass. There's a controversial statement, but there you go. Hinduism Today. This interesting piece on the origins of Christmas appeared in the Religion News Service and is written by Ivan Betau, something like that. Did you know that Alabama was the first state to declare Christmas an official holiday? That happened in 1836, 71 years before the last state, Oklahoma, followed suit in 1907. Christmas is the only legal national religious holiday in the United States. While it has been less than 100 years since all 50 states recognized Christmas as an official holiday, December 25th has been celebrated for centuries by Christians as Jesus' birthday. But until 245 AD, when a group of scholars tried to determine the date of Christmas, the question had never been addressed. According to a 1995 article by Victor M. Parachin in the Christian Reader, however, the project by the early church theologians to determine the date of his birth was denounced by a church council, which thought it was wrong to celebrate Jesus' birthday, quote, as though he were a king or pharaoh, unquote. That didn't prevent the scholar theologians from continuing their quest to determine the day Jesus was born. They originally listed four dates, January 1st, January 6th, March 25th, and May 20th, as possibilities, according to Parachin's research. It wasn't until 349 AD that December 25th was formally chosen as Christmas Day by Pope Julius. The date was already celebrated as the Natalis Soli Invicti, in honor of the sun god Mithras, by the Roman citizens. They decorated their homes in greenery, they exchanged gifts, and they gathered for festive meals on that date, observed just after the winter solstice. Many scholars believe that Pope Julius picked December 25th as Christmas Day to convert the followers of Mithra to Christianity, in addition to providing Christians with an opportunity to celebrate Jesus' birth. Christmas continued, however, to be a contentious issue. In the 17th century England and early America, English Puritans said the Bible offered no clear basis for celebrating Jesus' birth. In 1643, the English Parliament outlawed not only Christmas, but Easter and other Christian celebrations. But by 1660, Christmas had become such a popular holiday that that law was repealed. After the Pilgrims arrived in Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1620, the English misgivings about Christmas celebrations continued. In 1659, people in Massachusetts who celebrated Christmas were fined. That law was struck down in 1681 because the popularity of observing Christmas had grown immensely. However, Christian groups remained divided over whether Christmas should be celebrated because of its ties to pagan observances. The Lutherans, the Dutch Reformed, the Catholic, and Anglican churches forged ahead with the celebrations, while the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Quakers, and Puritans continued to rail against it. Even today, some Christian groups, including many Churches of Christ and Seventh-day Adventists, do not acknowledge Christmas as a religious observance. How does he conclude? Now Satguru Sivaya Subramunyat Swami has created a modern-day festival of Pancha Ganapati to coincide with the Christmas celebration for Hindus who are living in the West. And it's a means of participating in the festive season without all the trappings of another religious holiday. So What did they do? They did the same thing that everybody else has done. Well, there's a party this day anyway.
Let's join it.
Exactly.
We'll make it ours. We'll just take over.
We'll just bring everything into that December 25th pagan holiday, and we'll just all celebrate. But listen, that was a Hindu writing who understood that Christmas is a pagan holiday. It just seems to be the Christians, the people who are supposed to be following Christ, who don't seem to understand that. But everybody else does. Now, I never got to the Bible verses, so we're going to do that next week. We're going to read the real story of the birth of Christ. And we're going to, again, have to expose some of the traditions, like the wise men, who were never there when the baby was born. They came to the house he was living in when he was about 2, which explains why Herod killed all the children 2 and under. It's so illogical to think that the wise men could have gotten there. By the way, there weren't 3, and they weren't kings. Get that out of your head. So, is God mad? That's a really good question. James asked, so is God mad about this? What do you think? Does he love anything more than he loves his son? Oh, he loves his son. And the birth of his son and the death of his son are the 2 most magnificent events in human history on planet Earth. God became man in human flesh, and he died for the sins of his people when he let his own creation nail him to a tree. These are the most magnificent events. The epoch of human life on planet Earth are the death and birth of Jesus Christ, and they are both now named and called and surrounded by absolutely pagan worship that God, all through the Old Testament, told his people, don't do. Can God possibly wink at this? Can he possibly not be mad by it? Can God possibly be looking at the whole world and saying, sure, it's a giant Springer episode, but I don't care. I'm all right with sin. I don't care. Now, there is, fortunately for us, in the Old Testament, statements about God where it says that he understands that we do things in ignorance, that he looks at us and he knows that we are but dust, and that he pities us the way a father pities their child because he knows that we just don't know any better. Will God forgive people for the ignorant things they do? Yes, we still call the days of the week by pagan names. Is God, you know, up there ticking off and checking off every time we do that so he can hold it against us? No, we live in a pagan culture as the Jews in the first century did that Jesus walked into. But Jesus walked around telling these people, don't be part of that culture. Paul told us not to be conformed to this world, but to be transformed, to have our minds renewed by the Christ that lives within us. Can we change the world and get the whole world to stop celebrating Christmas? No, it's not going to happen. But for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, as Joshua said. And the service of the Lord is such, at this point in my life, where I cannot, in good conscience, continue pagan worship and pretend that it has anything to do with Christianity. You're going to hear this same speech in the spring when it comes Ishtar time. We celebrate the Passover, and we meet here, and we take the Lord's Supper, because all of that stuff is biblical. But sunrise and Ishtar has absolutely nothing to do with Christianity. Now, what are you going to do about it? That's up to you. Like I said, we ate turkey and more chocolate goodies than we should have, and passed around gifts yesterday, and had a real nice time together. I think we all have to deal individually with our conscience once we know the truth, because the truth will set you free. And I've been saying that for weeks and weeks now. The truth will set you free. So you go with what Jennifer commented earlier, your Christian conscience, and you decide what's right for your house and your kids. But if I come to your house and you have a manger scene with wise men and Santa Claus in it, I will knock it down. Okay?
You just moved to the other room like it took 2 years to get there?
Yeah, exactly. Okay? You deal with it individually. I can't speak for God and say God's angry about all this stuff. I just can't imagine how he couldn't be. I have an whole Old Testament where he told the Israelites, now when you go into the land of Canaan, there will be people there worshiping foreign gods. Don't be part of it. And now the church that bears the name of Christ has inculcated all those same Babylonish customs that God told his people, don't be any part of. How God cannot be upset about that, I don't possibly know. I can't imagine that it does not upset God. But Does that mean that Christians, blood-bought Christians, can lose their salvation over these things? No, these are matters of conscience that once you know the truth, you have to deal with God on. Okay, fair enough? Next week, we'll look at the biblical story of the birth of Christ. Okay? All right.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.